Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed, except this week where it's a little bit different and where I've got a little glimpse into my pre-science fiction book review podcast book reviewing days. You'll see what I mean in a minute. First of all, I've not read quite so much recently because I've been on holiday and I'm keeping myself very, very busy doing all kinds of different things. And each night at the end of the day, end of a busy day, I open my book and I get about two pages in and then fall asleep. And then the next day I'll do the same kind of thing, all busy, and then open up my book and fall asleep within four pages. I'm not saying the book isn't very good, it's just I'm doing a lot and I'm very tired as I'm reading. But, you know, over the next few days I should probably be able to finish up my current book that I'm reading. Anyway, because this book is taking too long to read, I thought I would respond to a few emails, but respond to one of the emails in a very specific way, and that's from Joseph Summers. I'll mention that in a second. First of all, I've got a few emails saying, hey, Fall of Hyperion was a bit crap. Yes, but the next two books in this series are really, really good. And I believe you. Everyone who sent me an email, there's been about four or five people who sent me emails along those lines, and that's great, but I'm just not exactly rushing into another Dan Simmons book right at the moment, which is a pity for Dan Simmons and all the other people who are a fan of that series, but I'm just not going to go for it straight away. But I'll put them in my list. Definitely put them in my list. And I've got a few other good book suggestions as well. Now, the best way to keep track of who's or what books have been suggested to me, and if you want to sort of say, yeah, you really should get to this one, is go to goodreads.com/Luke Burridge, and you can look at my bookshelves there. Anyway, moving on to some other emails. I got quite a few about Old Man's War, my previous review, and but specifically I want to talk or respond to the email from Joseph Summers. Here Joseph says, I'll respond as I go through the email to different points. He says, I heard recently on your podcast on this book, and while I recently heard your podcast on this book, and while I agree that the book is not exactly his best work, 3 out of 5 seems reasonable enough, some of the points you raised seemed a bit off base. One thing that I'll give you is that the author seemed to thematically borrow heavily from a number of science fiction classics, and he puts Steel Beach, Forever War, Starship Troopers. Now, I've never actually read Steel Beach, but I do, as I mentioned just before, I do actually have it there, and that was the book in the last podcast which I said I'm going to skip this one for a bit because it seemed to be saying, hey, yeah, this is great, another book in the style of Heinlein. I thought, oh, I just had a book in the style of Heinlein, so I'll go. Anyway, Joseph continues. He said, you felt like there was insufficient plot development around John Perry and his past life, but the book is about his new life as a soldier, not about how his experiences as a younger man on a polluted and crowded Earth helped shape who he is. I felt like the author tried to develop our understanding of his personality by showing how the training that he went through shaped his life. Perhaps he wasn't successful as doing as you would have liked, but Orson Scott Card used similar techniques to great effect in Ender's Game, including using other characters as foils to help push along the plot exposition and develop our understanding of certain key technologies. So I'll take a break there. Thanks a lot for that comment, Joseph. You mentioned Ender's Game here. The thing is, there's a big difference between Ender's Game and Battlescore. When Ender goes into... No, not into Battlescore. When Ender's Game and Old Man's War. So when Ender goes into Battlescore, he's just 6 years old. But compared to Old Man's War, where John Perry goes into his battle school, style of battle school, and he's 70-year-old, Ender seems to have a lot more life experiences when he's 6-year-old than John Perry does at 70, and he has a much more rounded personality. And that was the point when I was reading this book. It's like, of course you think back to these other sort of military science fiction things, you know, and people start going to training, but that's the whole point of these books, isn't it? That they have some past and then they're shaped and they're molded in a different direction, taken in a different direction. But like when a 6-year-old child has more of a history and more of a fleshed out history and just more things to draw on than a 70-year-old, I'm just thinking there's a lot of stuff going on there. And in this way, like Ender's Game and Old Man's War are like opposites in their sort of gimmicky premises. Like retirees joining the battle school or young children joining the battle school. But, you know, like Old Man's War could have forgotten about the old people part and read exactly the same. The only thing that matters in Old Man's War is that he's lost his wife before he's gone into the war. That's it. But he doesn't need to be 17-year-old because, like, for the most part, he runs around acting like an adolescent. And for this is like a central idea of the book. There just wasn't enough going for it. You know, the whole sort of like central idea that you have to be 70-year-old to sign up for the army. But there was nothing in the rest of the book which made it feel like that, except that he was old enough to have a wife and then lose his wife. And again, I think you just, if he'd included more, if John Scalzi had included more about John Perry in the book, I would have bought into it more, and I'd have seen it going for, you know, there'd been more, you know, just more to it, but there wasn't anything. And that's the thing about John Perry. Like I say, he was the vaguest protagonist in the entire, like, in my reading history, I think, probably, maybe, one of them. Especially for a novel. Let me put it this way, for a protagonist of a novel, one of the vaguest ever characters. Anyway, Joseph's second point. He says, you derided the flow of the action during his earlier career as a soldier. And I felt like the whole point of this part of the book was to show how Perry's unconventional method of thinking and approach to tactics was not just a flash in the pan during his training, but also showed that he was destined for greatness among his peers. Joseph continues, I found it a bit cliche, to be honest, but I did not feel like it was pointless part of the whole process of developing the character and moving the story along. First of all, I didn't really feel like the story did move along in that second part of the book, in part two of the book. Sure, there was a few points when it sort of moved along, but it was only at the end of part two where actually any story continued. And just things happening doesn't mean that story is happening. But my main problem is that John Perry's unconventional method of thinking, as you put it there, and his approach to tactics, didn't shine through for me at all. He was put into these very generic situations, and he made some very bland and obvious decisions and very obvious tactics. Like in the training exercise, he said, oh, what normally people do, they send out their troops in small groups and they work together as groups. And he sent out his entire, all these troops, as solo operatives, and they would communicate via BrainPal and coordinate via BrainPal. And I was thinking, like, yeah, sure, of course, why not do that? And then we read that this is meant to be some kind of revolutionary tactic. And when I'm reading this kind of thing, I'm just thinking, no, this isn't. And it's like the same thing with his firing solution. You know, he programs his computer to press the trigger twice for him, and it's like, great. But it wasn't this genius order that I felt like it should have been. It's like he wasn't being very clever. Everyone else in the entire story seemed to just be being a bit stupid. Now, contrast this with Ender's Game, the book that you sort of brought up earlier here. Ender goes into the Zero Gravity War Room. I'll explain a bit more, I guess, later on in the podcast anyway. So there's this Zero Gravity War Room in the middle of the battle school, and it is a novel situation, not just for Ender, but for me as a reader. And this is important. John Perry went into situations which were very, very bland and boring, like literally just drop infantry down, shoot bad aliens. That was it. That's all he ever had to do. And we were told in Old Man's War that these different situations were really frightening. You never know quite what you were getting into. But you did. It was drop down onto a planet and shoot aliens with big guns. But in Ender's Game, we see that, like, this sort of, like, situation that he's put into in the battle school where he really shines through with his tactics. Like I say, it's a very strange situation. Nobody's ever been in that. And it actually sets up, but it doesn't explain specifically, but you see that everybody else who's trained in the battle room brings this baggage with them, and that the baggage is, of course, that they've grown up on Earth with gravity, and they think in more two dimensions, you know. And then when we get into the battle school with Ender, into the zero gravity war training room, and he suddenly goes, okay, the enemy's gate is down. It's that classic line, the enemy's gate is down, and everyone goes, ah, it's down. And they suddenly thinks in three dimensions, and there's so many different new techniques and tactics he can think of and use in there. And when you're reading those tactics, you're thinking, oh yeah of course. When I was reading the tactics of John Perry, I'm thinking, yeah. And yeah, and with Ender's Game, I'm thinking, oh yeah, all right, I get it, you know, and that kind of thing. So comparing Ender and John Perry, and like you say, it was a bit cliche. It's sort of like, oh yes, John Perry, he got them out of this different situation. You know, if John Perry was in Ender's army, in the Dragon Army, or whichever one it was, you know, I would have. You know, Ender would have kicked John Perry out of his army for being too slow-minded. That's what it was, and actually everyone else who was fighting alongside John Perry. Anyway, Joseph, he continues onto his next point here. He says, in Starship Troopers or the Forever War, the protagonist has a distinct lack of specialness throughout the story that never really was exemplified by their experiences, but the storytelling of the particular battles was what really drew you in. Scalzi's writing misses the energy of Holden or Heinlein on that score, but I think the section of the book, this is the second section of the book he's talking about, works well to set up the third part of the story. Well, to be honest, yeah, it does sort of work well to set up the third part of the story, but I'll just comment on this sort of like, talking about Starship Troopers and Forever War. Actually, no, I'll just stick to Forever War because I have actually reviewed that on the podcast. In Forever War, it wasn't about being a great soldier. It was a little bit about being a soldier, and it wasn't about how clever the soldiers were. It was actually more about how not very clever the soldiers were and not very clever the people giving the orders were, you know? And it wasn't really about the exciting battles, and it really wasn't, you know, it wasn't about the military part of the military science fiction. It was really a story about, like, the futility of war and how hard it is for the soldiers who fight and how difficult it is, you know, to return from war and find that the world that you once knew has completely changed and you've also changed a lot as well. And, you know, Joe Haldeman, who wrote Forever War, is a Vietnam War veteran, and of course the Forever War is obviously a very personal story for him. That's what his story is about. It's not really about the particular battles, even though it did. They do draw you in a way, but often it's sort of like they drop down as a planet, kill all the aliens and go, oh, that wasn't very difficult, what's going on here then? Yeah, it's just a whole different story. Old Man's War, on the other hand, to contrast with the Forever War, is really about how cool it is to shoot aliens with big guns, and not really a lot of thought. Maybe there is some other points there, but the main point is really, hey, look at this. I've got a cool gun. I've got a new body. I've got this brain thing in my, you know, this brain pal, this computer in my head, and I'm going to use it to kill aliens. Only until you get to the third part of the book do you really actually catch sort of like the good part, which I really enjoyed about John Sculls' Old Man's War, which is a pity because I don't really want to spoil it. But, you know, there's stuff goes on there where you actually realise what the book's about. But like I said in my previous podcast, you realize that that book is about someone who isn't John Perry, someone with a lot less past, but with actually a lot more interesting character than John Perry will ever be, or seems he'll ever be. And it was only when he meets someone with no history do you actually find anything about his history, and he meets someone without any basis for his character to get to know his character. And I don't really want to spoil it very much, but that's the kind of thing that you're up to there. Anyway, Joseph's last point. In his email, he says, I think you should read the next book in the series because it is a bit less bland, you know, a little bit less bland portrayal of Perry. It also gives a more holistic coverage to the military and the political context of Old Man's War universe. So you really have a better sense of the tension between the human colonists, the colonial government, the other galactic species, and where Perry's story fits in with the entire milieu. He says there's less action, but I still found the story satisfying. 3.5 stars out of 5 is what he gives the second book in the series. And to be honest, like I say, I'll probably give it a go if it's a better book, if it picks up a bit. And to be honest, less action would be really good. I don't want more action. I want more other stuff, or I want at least the action to tie in with the sort of wider world, or even with the sort of internal world of John Perry. But it seems like this next book in the series does, so I'll probably pick it up and read it. And Joseph finishes his email. He says, I noticed that you did not review Ender's Game, which has to be one of the consensus top 5 or 10 books for any science fiction fan, particularly military science fiction. I recommend you giving it a whirl when you get some time, but perhaps it would be hard to review since it's such a strong title. Thanks for the email. Joseph, as it happened, I have reviewed Ender's Game, but not for this podcast. A few years ago, the Simply Syndicated Network, which does the Movies You Should See podcast, that's their main podcast that they do. I'm not even sure they still do it because I don't listen to it anymore, any of the podcasts from the network. They sort of faded away for me when the cast changed around. Anyway, they had this idea for a podcast called Books You Should Read. And it would be it would feature sort of listener submitted reviews of books that they thought other people should read. And at the time, I was in the planning stages of this podcast, this science fiction book review podcast. And so I thought about submitting something, and I'd already recorded a few sort of test runs at different reviews. But I thought this would be a good way to do a test run with some audience actually listening to it, giving some feedback. So I sent in a review for the Books You Should Read podcast. And as it happened, they seemed to like the review quite a lot because it was featured as episode number 1 of the Books You Should Read podcast. And I chose Ender's Game, like as you said, because it's a great book and it's generally considered one of the top, as it says, consensus top 5 or 10 science fiction books. And also because I thought it was a good book. If you've never read science fiction before, it's a good way into science fiction. That's what I think, anyway. And actually, later on, I sent in another 2 reviews to the Books You Should Read podcast. One was Word Freaks by Stefan Fatsis, which is about learning Scrabble, so completely different. And the third book that I sent in a review in for was Genesis, which is best known as the first book of the Bible. And again, a completely different kind of thing. But I thought it was fun to review the first book in the Bible. Anyway, so I listened back to this episode of Ender's Game to see how far I've come, you know, in reviewing and what if anything changed. I still agree with about 95% of what I say in the review. I don't cover much in the way of negative points in the book because the idea of the Books You Should Read podcast is to convince someone to read a book. And also, if it's going to be this first ever science fiction novel, I thought, well, I won't sort of talk it down in any way. I was, of course, going to slant more towards the positive to get people to read the book. So, thankfully, in Ender's Game, there is a lot of positive stuff to cover. So, what I'll do is just play that review for you right now, and I'll see you on the other side. Enjoy this. Hello and welcome to the new show from Simply Syndicated, Books You Should Read. It's a continuation of the Nouns You Should Verb franchise to go along with such shows as Movies You Should See and Albums You Should Hear. If you don't recognise my voice, well, that's because this show is about listener contributions. So it's not just the regular Simply Syndicated cast spouting their views. So my name is Luke Burridge. And I'm going to be doing the book review this week. I'm an avid reader, mainly of science fiction books, which means that hopefully in the future I'm going to be reviewing some of my favourite classic sci-fi books. But today I'm not going to go back that far. Instead, I've picked a novel to review that was first published as a short story in 1977 and then published as a full-length novel in 1985. I think there was a slightly updated version with a few corrections and differences published just a few years later. Anyway, I've chosen this book mainly because it's actually a great way into science fiction for a casual reader. So if you've never actually tried to read any science fiction book before at all, give this one a go because, just don't be put off just because it's science fiction. It's actually a really good read. And the book is, that I'm going to be reviewing today, Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card. Ender's Game, that's the book. First, a bit about the author, though. I think Orson Scott Card started out, I think he was a playwright and a poet, and he's worked a lot as a journalist, and then he became a sort of full-time a novelist. And of course, from then on, he's become one of the major authors. He's won many of the big science fiction book awards, like the Hugo and Nebula, like many times. And of all of the sort of big major science fiction authors out there, he is very strange. He's very unique, in fact, because he's one of the only ones who is openly religious, both in his works, in the novels that he writes, and just in his life. He's a practicing Mormon, in fact, which is very strange because, as far as I know, Mormons, don't they believe that Jesus is going to return in a few years' time and that'll be the end of the world? And yet, Orson Scott Card, he writes science fiction generally set well into the future, past the end of the date, you know, of the end of the universe. Anyway, religion doesn't come into Ender's Game much, certainly not to the extent of some of Orson Scott Card's other stories, such as Folk of the Fringe and the Homecoming Saga. In fact, the Homecoming Saga is I think it's five books in a series based on the Book of Mormon, like a science fiction retelling of that story, which is quite interesting because I only noticed that after about two books into that story. Anyway, let's get to Ender's Game. The premise of the story seems quite basic at the start, you know, quite a normal science fiction kind of tale. It starts about 100 years from the present, and an alien species has invaded the solar system. You know, it's threatening Earth. In fact, they've, I think, invaded twice in the past from where the book is set, and humans are almost totally wiped out, but miraculously win through in the end against the aliens. Now, the aliens are called Buggers, which sounds a bit strange now that I said it out loud. I guess I've only ever read this name for the aliens before, but they're called Buggers because they look like bugs, and I always imagine them, after seeing the film Starship Troopers, as like those bugs, the hive mind from that film, but maybe more intelligent, because I know they use technology and advanced weapons and space vehicles, all the great science fiction stuff. But we don't really see Buggers so much in this book, because it's actually set 80 years after the humans sneak this victory over the Buggers, but we know that they're returning. So after a period of about 80 years, the Buggers are going to come back to Earth and finish us off. Oh, that's the idea. So Earth, the governments of Earth get together and they start working out what do we need. What do we need? We need ships. They build lots of ships. They need all this different kind of stuff. Weapons. They build lots of weapons. The thing that they don't really have a lot of after lots of peacetime on Earth is any good military minds, any good tactical commanders. So they start a selective breeding program in the population of Earth to come up with these new tactical masterminds and commanders, so the forces of Earth in the future, when the buggers come back again, those silly buggers, they come back again, we'll have some, you know, masterminds, these military masterminds to take on the buggers at their own game of inter-solar system warfare. So these commanders are actually taken at an extremely young age. They're bred in the population, extremely young age, put into what's known as the battle school. And the battle school is just simply to hone their, you know, instincts to, so they do become these pure military geniuses, or genii, or genii. Actually, I don't know what the... I'm not a genie anything, I guess. So anyway, the worst graduates from the battle school, they're just put in charge of single platoons and in charge of single spaceships or whatever. And the best and the brightest and the most perfect graduate of the entire battle school, that student will be put in charge of the entire Earth Defense Force. And the majority of the book, Ender's Game, follows the story of one of the latest on last recruits of the battle school, and how he becomes, you know, the likely contender for that top spot of commander of the forces of Earth. So that's the idea of the book. It sounds a bit strange. It's very sci-fi, of course, but so let's just get into the book a bit more. The main characters, of course, the main character is the Ender in the title, and this is his game that he's playing, if you will. His real name is Andrew Wiggin, but he was called Ender at a young age by his sister, and the name sticks with him throughout the book and throughout his life. He's actually got an older brother and sister. They're called Peter and Valentine, both of who were considered for entry into the battle school to be taken on and become future leaders. But Peter, the older brother, was judged to be too violent and too uncaring, and the book actually depicts him to begin with as like a complete psycho. It's quite disturbing, in fact, some of the things that he does. And Valentine, his older sister, was considered too soft, too likeable, too human in a way, which is very strange. So they actually, you know, the authorities tell the parents of these two children, well, you've got one that's too good, you've got one that's too bad, try for a third child, and hopefully he comes out right. And actually it works. So Andrew Wiggin is born, and he's exactly the right mix of these values of his brother and sister, and he's a complete genius. And at 6 years old, he's taken to the battle school to learn military tactics. That's right, at 6 years old, he gets taken to battle school. And this book is actually about the child, Andrew Wiggin, Ender, and it's about children, but it's not a book... Well, it's not a children's book. It's about a book about children, but not really a children's book. You can read it when you're young, if you're young. I read it when I was probably about 12 or 13 for the first time, and I enjoyed it. But actually, I've read it twice now since I'm in my 20s, let me put it that way. And I've enjoyed it more, actually, then. So it's a book accessible for all. So most of the main characters in this book are children between, say, about 6 years old and 12, maybe 16 years old at the very oldest. But you never really get a feel that they're children, because you actually identify with them so much, because you remember, hey, when I was that age, when I was 12 years old, that's how I thought. You know, it's a very strange thing that it doesn't talk down to the children in the book. It doesn't make them feel like children. It treats them as adults, which I think is very very unique in a book that actually deals with children as the main characters. So Ender, Andrew Wiggin, he is the genius who's meant to be on par with the greatest minds of history. He's like a generations long breeding program that's been put in place to get this guy to be like some kind of young Superman. Even then, even though he is a genius, he's quite easy to identify with, like I said before. But he's a young child, but he's being trained to be a warrior. His only purpose in life is to kill a lot of alien yet sentient beings. Of course, the rest of the world is setting up the children at the battle school to be like the new saviors of the human race, but Ender just isn't really taken with that idea very much at all. And a lot of the book is about this. A lot of the themes of the book is about Ender, you know, trying to become what's expected of him, but sort of battling against it at the same time. And also the main theme is children as soldiers comes through very much in this book. So anyway, what I was saying is that the children are trained in military tactics and command at the Battle School. And the Battle School is in orbit around Earth, which sounds a bit stupid to begin with. It's like, why don't you just send them to a normal school? But they have to learn how to control and to do tactics with spaceships in three dimensions and in zero gravity, which is the arena that they'll be doing battle with against the buggers when they come to Earth in the future. So that's where they're trained, in orbit, and it's actually quite an interesting setup. The main training is in these pitched battles between two armies of about 40 students in each sort of army, and takes place, of course, they're just going around in this zero gravity room in the center of the battle school. And these armies have different names, and Ender soon becomes the commander of the Dragon Army, and you sort of start to get a taste of how he commands his troops. Of course, all the troops are just other young children at the battle school. Other training includes lots of reading about all kinds of topics like history and maths and all sorts of stuff like that. And other training is computer games and this fantasy game, which it's set up like just a game, but you soon learn that it's an elaborate way for the tutors to actually look at what the children are doing and sort of keep track of the psychological development of the children, which all sounds quite fun, really, doesn't it? Zero gravity and war games and computer games and things. But it's actually really, really brutal for Ender, because at the very start of the book, the tutors know that this guy, this young boy, is going to be someone special, and they really, really want to make him the best that they possibly can. But that includes putting him in a lot of danger, not just in the battle room, but in like actual danger. They sort of encourage bullying in the school to make him feel pressured, and he's alienated from a lot of the other students as well, to really sort of make him see what he's going to do in times of real need. So it's not just academic. They actually see what he does in real situations of peril. And I could actually go a lot more into the story of Ender, but if I keep taking it too far, I think it'll just be spoiling it, because, there is some plot twists in this book, and to be honest, they're some of the most satisfying plot twists I've ever read in about my sort of last 15, 16 years of reading science fiction novels and reading in general. It is actually quite amazing what takes place. So I'm going to take you back to a subplot of the book, which follows Ender's brother and sister, because there they are. Those two were meant to be just as fantastic, just as genius, just as sort of superhuman as Ender himself, but they don't have anything to do because they're not in battle school. They've been rejected for various reasons, and so they don't have anything to do. So what they do, I don't really know how to... Tell you what, I'll just describe one of the cooler science fiction kind of creations in the book, because the battle school is great, and there's all these other kinds of things that are really good sort of science fiction creations, sort of technological creations, including the main weapon, which is called the molecular disruptor bomb, which can sort of wipe out sort of whole cities and whole space stations and whole armies in one go. It's quite amazing. But one of the coolest things is what Orson Scott Card called a network, I think, in the book. And the network, a little bit like the internet, where you can post essays and thoughts or anything on any subject, and then people will read those essays and comment on them, and then write their own essays in response and post them under their own name and things. So in other words, Card pretty much predicted the blogosphere dead on. Not exactly the same as the blogosphere, but pretty much as we know it. But this blogosphere has taken over, this is like 150 years in the future, taken over television and radio and podcasting in terms of importance and influence in the world. So what Peter does, he makes a plan that himself and Valentine start posting to the network under pseudonyms called Locke and Demosthenes. I think that's the name of it, I can't remember exactly. Demosthenes. So Valentine is Demosthenes, and she starts writing as a sort of political analyst kind of person, but as a sort of quite right-wing, fear-mongering, war-mongering kind of trouble-stirring character. And Peter, under the name of Locke, he promotes much more sort of liberal views and argues for peace and cooperation and love and all that kind of stuff. But he's not the nice guy in real life. He's a complete psycho. You know, in the book he tortures and kills squirrels for fun, and but the big him being a good guy is all part of his evil genius. It's all part of the plan. So what happens after a few years of doing this, they both on the network have a huge following,
And nobody knows that they're just two 12-year-old kids or 12, 13-year-old kids. But they become very, very influential in the political landscape back down on Earth. But nobody knows even that they're Ender Wiggins' brother and sister or anything like that. And the idea is that after the buggers are defeated or after the end of the war with the aliens, Peter, as Locke, will sort of defeat Demosthenes as sort of like in a general debate and sort of take over and become the most powerful sort of political critic intellect remaining on the internet or in the network or whatever it's called. And that's the main idea. So that's the main characters and sort of the subplots. Things I guess I really liked about the book. One would be that, of course, the story is just really good. The storytelling itself. The writing style is a bit rough in places, I guess, but you can't knock it because it's just such a great read. And it's so satisfying to be put into a situation with Ender and just to see how he comes through that situation and sort of how you think along with him. I would have done, you know, I'd have done that too. But then, of course, in the next situation, because he's some kind of weird, evil genius at the same time as being a fantastic kid, you just look at him and you just go think, wow, I'd never have done that. I'd never have thought of that at all. That is quite a really freaky thing to do, and a freaky kid that we've got there. So it kind of walks a fine line between you finding Ender as the main character really likable and that you can really identify with him, and yet at the same time it keeps reminding you that the main reason this kid exists in the first place is just to kill without mercy. That's his main job in life, and that's what he's been brought up to do, and that's what he's being trained to do. And it sort of really sends shivers up your spine when you suddenly realise that about a child. You think, wait a second, this kid's just 8 years old, six, 8 years old, and then you realise that his only purpose in life is to be, it's to be a warrior and a killer. The supporting characters in the book, very believable. I really like the tutors at the battle school, the teachers there, because they walk a thin line too between sort of wanting the best for Ender and the best for the students, and also the best for Earth, for humanity itself, because, you know, that's what they're there to do, to train up the next generation of military minds to take over. Each chapter actually begins with a short conversation between two of the staff members. You don't know who they are, but, you know, it's another little plot that goes on between the staff at the school and how they think the best way to treat Ender is, and how to control his life and how to set up situations. And it's the kind of thing that sort of makes you paranoid. You know, when I read this for the first time when I was young, just starting a new school, I was thinking, oh, wait a second, maybe the teachers are the same here as well. They're actually setting up bullies in the school and some kind of system to sort of pick on me. Of course, no, not really. And actually, strangely enough, in this book, there's not, like, a main villain. There's not a main bad guy. Or to pick one out is quite hard, because Peter, at the beginning, is definitely the villain. He's the one who's sort of Ender's antagonist. But beyond the first few chapters, you don't see him so much. He actually is very calculating that he stops being so psychotic himself. And you begin rooting for him as like a kind of anti-hero, with him and Valentine trying to take over the political world. The buggers, you don't see them because the book isn't about the battle with the buggers. It's about Ender going through the battle school. And I guess the tutors, I've just mentioned them as well. Some people have suggested, and I've actually seen some quite in-depth discussions about Ender himself as the villain, about how you can compare him with Adolf Hitler, but, you know, I wouldn't take it that far, but it's something to ponder. The other cool things about the books, the science part of science fiction is quite strong, like I mentioned before, again, with all the gadgets and the science and the settings in space and stuff. That's all really interesting. But the main excitement really comes from the vividness of the battles and the techniques that Ender, you know, comes up with, and the training that he has to endure. And it's not just the cool descriptions of the tactics that, you know, he uses. It's not just that that's fun, really. It's because each experience that you take with him and go along with him, they both add to the storyline and to Ender's development as a character, which is really, really well written. I guess the final word would be about the main themes and the intentions of the author, because it's clear that Card wants to bring up big issues with his books, you know, issues like the meaning of life and humanity and morals and all these other great big literary topics. But Card states in the introduction to some of his books, I can't remember if it's in the introduction to this book, that he doesn't, you know, he doesn't think that literature should be beyond the reach of anyone. And so this book is very much about the big subjects, but you read it and it doesn't just scream at you, take me seriously, and this is a literature book, and boom, boom, boom. You know, the tone is really light and easy to read, and it just effortlessly takes you into these situations and makes you think about these big topics without sounding, you know, preachy or high-minded about it. So you can read the book on many levels. If you just want a straight entertaining novel about science fiction and space battles and saving the Earth from aliens, you can do that. But if you want a good read as a study on the human condition and how we're influenced by environment or influenced by our genetics or on what civil liberties should be restricted for the sake of security and, you know, loads and loads of other big topics, get into this book. So to wrap it up, I'd just say, I guess, what's that, four words? This is a book you should read. And one other further note, I guess, about further reading. This is actually the first book in a series called The Ender Series or something like that. The next book, Speaker for the Dead, is certainly of the same quality, but not really of the same theme because it's Ender as an adult with his time as Valentine many years later. But it's a good book. The series continues with a few others. But I start then to get what I call sequel fatigue, which is the feeling as you go along that the quality is going down and the ideas are sort of wearing thin or wearing out. It's not as bad as many series by many other authors out there, but because I enjoyed all the books in some ways, but they, you know, they take you far away from the feel of the first book. And there's another series as well that sort of starts as a parallel story to Ender's Game, and it's called Ender's Shadow, and it talks about another student at the battle school called Bean, and this series continues with the word shadow in all the book's titles. But I haven't actually made it all the way through that series because the sequel fatigue was running a bit high, so I'm making sure I put at least a year or two between each book in this series. So there you go. Also, Ender's Game, I just actually looked it up, and it says it's in production for a movie, with the script being a treatment done by Orson Scott Card himself, the author, which may be a good sign, but then The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy film was written by the author of the book, and look how that turned out. But I really do suggest reading this book before you go out to the cinema. So, yeah, that's about it for the book you should read this week. There you go. That's the review of Ender's Game. I cut it off a little bit before the end of the podcast recording that I did there because it just I go off to talk about other simply syndicated shows there, which isn't really relevant to this. Now, I don't think I'd actually add very much now to that review, except, of course, my rating, which I normally give. Of course, I rate my books or my reading experiences exactly down to how much I enjoy them on a purely subjective level. And because there's not many books that I've read as many times as Ender's Game, I'd give it at least 4.5 stars. Maybe 5 stars. Actually, if I was going to go for the first time I read it, I would probably give it 5 stars. But now I'd give it probably about 4.5 stars out of 5. For just minor reasons, but again, you know, if I read it now, I'd probably still give it 4.5 stars. It is one of the best, like people say, it is one of the most enjoyable, maybe not the best, one of the most enjoyable science fiction books. Maybe I'll actually get around to reviewing some of the books that I really do think are the best science fiction books ever, or my most enjoyable science fiction books ever. But of course, I've always read them a few times, so I concentrate on other stuff. So anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this special episode. I'm not going to go into anything more about Orson Scott Card's, you know, recent activities, like his latest works and his latest writings and political activities. So I will move on, I think, and I'll continue my military science fiction reading in Steel Beach in a few books' time, I'm sure. And maybe I'll give Starship Troopers another spin as well. And again, I think it just comes down to it. I like military science fiction as long as it's got more going for it than just the military part. I think that's my conclusion so far with military science fiction. It has to have either compelling story or compelling character development or compelling themes. Old Man's War got there like by the end of the book, but entire section seemed to just be empty of anything, like I say, but exposition and info dumping and sort of mindless action or mindless chatter. The next book I'm going to read is the same as last episode, is Gold Coast by Kim Stanley Robinson. So far, it seems a little bit similar to his other novels, but he normally does that, and he normally starts slow, but I'm sure it's going to pick up. Also, I've got another email. I just checked it just a few minutes ago, and I said, are you going to do First and Last Men? Last and First Men by Olaf Stapleton.
And I do have that, and actually I just found it and I downloaded it, so it's now on my iPod, so I'll probably read it a lot quicker, because it's actually, it was quite a chunky book and I could never be bothered to carry it around anywhere, but I will get to it, I'm sure, quite soon. So that's about it. Follow me on my blog, which is lukeburridge.com/blog, or go to lukeburridge.com/ I think it's fiction.html to read my latest novel, Minding Tomorrow. It's called that. Or if you want to read my second novel, which I'm just finishing doing an edit on, and it's ready to send out to first readers, so send me an email saying, yes, I want to read Monster Story, which is very different from my first novel. But if you want to check it out, give me feedback to help in the editing process. Email me, luke@juggler.net, or with any other feedback. Otherwise, follow me on Twitter, lukeburridge. Twitter's at Luke, or goodreads.com/LukeBurridge. You'll work it out. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.